Chapter 17. To Irene's surprise, everything they needed for drilling down to the first projector fit inside the Buzzard with room to spare. The Ruhar designers had cleverly packaged the portable drill rig so it collapsed on itself and could crawl up the Buzzard's rear ramp on its own. They wouldn't be able to deploy the drill rig that way at a projector site, but it was still an impressive feat of engineering. Everything was squared away with 2 hours to spare. So the five caught a quick nap and were awakened in the pitch-dark night by a message from Emby. After a quick breakfast of nutrient mushes, they checked that the truck was securely hidden. Then Irene began walking around the Buzzard for a pre-flight inspection.
"What kind of name is Strebik, ma'am?"
Jesse asked as he held a light for their pilot. He pronounced the name Strebik as Irene had done.
"It's German," Irene said as she opened an access panel and checked an actuator.
"German?" Jesse said, surprised.
"I know," Irene laughed and looked at her arm's light brown skin. "My father is German, and the joke was that I came from gypsies. My mother's name is Elena Ramos. She was in Germany with the army and married a German man over there."
"She was in the army, ma'am?"
Irene nodded. "She was a Black Hawk pilot. She's why I became a pilot. She retired only 3 years before the hamsters hit us." She frowned.
Now the Ruhar were the closest thing UNEF had to allies. Life was certainly strange sometimes.
"Before we left Earth, she talked about re-enlisting to join UNEF, but it would have meant 6 months of training and she might not get flight duty anyway. Sometimes I wish that I hadn't gotten the recall notice," Jesse said honestly. "My father, my uncle, my cousin and I were all about to head out on a hunting trip. We planned to be gone a week or more. We were loading the truck when my mother told me I had a message from the 10th Division on my email. My cousin told me to ignore it, but I knew I couldn't. If we'd gotten that truck loaded earlier, I might not have seen that message until it was too late to go off-world. There wasn't any cell phone service up in the hills back then."
"I didn't have a choice," Irene said as she closed the access panel. "I was already back with the 10th Aviation at Fort Drum when we got the order to deploy to Ecuador."
She walked over to the left engine and pointed for Jesse to shine the light into the exhaust.
"How did you get involved with this?"
"Us?" Jesse asked. "The four of us were all together because of Joe Bishop." He told her the whole astonishing story as she finished the external pre-flight check.
"Do you think Bishop is really alive?" Irene asked quietly, trying to be sensitive that Jesse had been Joe's friend.
"Major Perkins says the hamsters think he is."
"Me?"
Jesse scratched his head.
"All I know is that Joe is one lucky son of a bitch. Always has been. He also has a nose for trouble. If there is trouble within 100 miles, you can be sure Bish will find himself in the middle of it sooner or later. What I can say is, I hope if he did find trouble, he didn't drag anyone else into it."
"He's right, Joe," Skippy said. "You sure dragged me and the whole merry band of pirates into a huge mess, didn't you?"
"Me?" I protested.
We had been listening to Jesse and Irene talk through their Z-phones, which they didn't realize were transmitting. I did feel guilty about eavesdropping. The reason I justified listening to them talk had been to prevent them from making mistakes they couldn't recover from.
"You were the one who got me into trouble, Skippy. If you hadn't opened the door to that warehouse, I would be on a farm in Lemuria right now."
"Or dead," I didn't say.
"Turn it off, please."
"Are you sure, Joe?"
"Yes, you're listening. You can tell us if they make a big mistake. It's creepy for me to be listening to them. I don't even know this Irene.
You read her service record and the profile I put together, Joe. That's not the same as meeting her in person."
"I wouldn't know about that," said the beer can, who never actually met anyone in person.
"Lieutenant Strebik is now in the cockpit and running her pre-flight checks there. I could tell her that I know everything is perfect with the aircraft, but a pilot would never take anyone's word about that, right?"
"You got it. I've only flown Theran in dropships, but before I fly, I am checking everything myself."
"Understood.
While we're waiting, Joe, I have a question."
"Skippy, it is unlikely that I have an answer, especially if your question is about 17th-century Hungarian poetry." "No, it's nothing like that."
"When you were at your parents' house, you borrowed your father's truck to drive into town."
"Yeah, so? I can drive, Skippy." Although right then I wondered whether my driver's license had expired. I'd been away from Earth for a while, after all.
"Your driving and piloting skills are debatable, Joe, but that is not my question. Why were you driving a truck? Why don't you have a Corvette?"
"A Corvette?" That question completely surprised me. I can't afford a Corvette, Skippy. Besides, what would I do with a car like that in Maine? It snows there 6 months a year. Why do you ask that?
I thought all astronauts drive Corvettes. Technically, you are an astronaut, Joe. You have flown spacecraft by yourself, and you even performed a space dive.
Huh. I never thought of myself as an astronaut, Skippy. Maybe you're right.
Maybe not. Real astronauts get laid a lot more than you.
That's because women know those guys are astronauts, Skippy. I can't tell anyone what we've been doing out here. Also, astronauts are a lot cooler than you, Joe. Goodbye, Skippy.
Sergeant Adams woke me and Captain Desai up early the next morning, as Perkins and her team approached the first projector site in the Buzzard. Many things could go wrong at this point. We all wanted to know what was happening in real time. I told Skippy to show us video from the Buzzard's cameras and sensors, and we would listen when they talked to each other on Z-phones. But we weren't going to eavesdrop this time.
"Are they clear?" Irene asked over the Z-phone earpiece.
The Buzzard's belly camera gave her a view beneath her, and Dave in the back was remotely aiming the camera where it needed to be. Still, with tons of equipment to be lowered to the ground, it made sense to be certain.
"Major Perkins confirms they are clear, yes. Should I begin lowering the sling now?" Dave asked.
"Do it. I want the drill rig on the ground before the wind picks up," Irene ordered.
This whole operation was too complicated, but she didn't know an easier way. The Kristang had deliberately installed the projectors in remote areas that would be unlikely to be developed for habitation, industry, or agricultural use. In most cases, this meant that trees had grown over the sites during the intervening years, and there was no way to land the Buzzard at the sites without the laboriously slow process of cutting a clearing. With the Buzzard, they had flown to any clear area near the first site and lowered Perkins and Jesse to the ground on a cable. Those two then cleared just enough trees out of the way while Irene landed the Buzzard and she helped Dave and Shauna unload the drill rig and secure it in a sling. The drill rig and its associated gear was now awkwardly slung beneath the Buzzard and needed to be carefully lowered through the gap in the trees. The sun would be rising in less than an hour, so they needed to get the drill rig, Shauna, and Dave on the ground as quickly as possible. Then Irene would park the Buzzard close by, cover it with a camouflage net, and wait. Wait. While the four others drilled down to a hidden chamber where a secret giant maser cannon could be reactivated. The weather forecast from MB was favorable, except that Irene expected the light breeze to pick up and become unpredictably gusty as the sun came over the horizon. The drill rig needed to be on the ground and the sling cable retracted before then. If the wind was blowing too strongly for Shauna and Dave to be lowered to the ground by cable, Irene could land the Buzzard and those two could walk to the projector site. The sling with the drill rig was fitted with thrusters that could be steered remotely, or it had a limited ability to guide itself. Perkins and Coulter had hammered a target into the ground where they wanted the sling to make contact. The sling would home in on that spot. Irene only needed to hover the Buzzard over the opening in the forest canopy, and either Dave or the sling's automated guidance system would handle dropping the package. That was great news for Irene. She had limited experience with hauling cargo by sling, and no recent experience. It was nerve-wracking to hover the Buzzard, one eye on the instruments and one eye on the treetops to the east. When the wind kicked up, leaves on the trees to the east would flutter and signal when the wind would reach the Buzzard. Irene used the leaves to anticipate when she would need to maneuver the lumbering Buzzard. In training, she had been able to hover within a 2-meter sphere, never varying more than a meter in any direction. In training, she never had a multi-ton weight suspended on the end of a cable beneath her ship.
"Down. It's down," Shauna called over the intercom. "Cable released."
Irene had felt the cable go slack. She had been watching the camera feed to anticipate when to reduce power. She couldn't help allowing herself a self-congratulatory smile. The drop had been nearly perfect, despite the morning winds picking up already.
"Retract cable," she ordered. "Jarrett, Chaika, the wind is too strong for you two to rappel down. I need to land, and you can hike in."
"Yes, ma'am," Dave replied unhappily.
Looking down at the waving treetops, he decided that maybe he shouldn't be unhappy about having to walk a kilometer or two through the woods that morning.
"I'll inform Major Perkins."
"No," Irene said flatly.
"No.
I wouldn't be asking if..." Shauna started to say.
"Shauna, no. No way. I became a pilot to be in the air, not underground."
"Irene, please think about it. None of us can do it. We tried.
Even Major Perkins tried, and she's bigger than I am. If we have to lift the drill and start again, it will take another full day, and MB is already pushing us for being too slow.
I don't believe this, Shauna.
It occurred to Irene then that under normal circumstances, Shauna should have addressed her as Lieutenant, or Ma'am, and she should have called the specialist Jared. These were anything but normal circumstances.
What happens if I get stuck down there? Who will fly the Buzzard?
Perkins' team had gotten the drill down 83 meters before it broke through to an open chamber, a chamber that didn't appear on their subsurface scans. Then they retracted the exploratory drill and fitted the widest drill bit available. It was slow going because of their inexperience with drilling, even with MB guiding them. More than once, MB had sent messages exhorting them to move faster. An exasperated Major Perkins had replied that if MB wanted them to drill more quickly, they should have sent someone with experience. Finally, after what Perkins knew was far too much time, the big drill was done. And then they discovered the problem MB had apparently not considered. None of the four drill crew members could fit down the hole. Shauna had tried first, but she was 5'7" and her shoulders simply were too wide. For once, she regretted the weight training she had done to qualify for infantry duty. The two men had made a half-hearted attempt to fit. Then Major Perkins had tried, but as she was 5'10", there was no way she would fit either. They were about to drill a second hole next to the first in order to widen the opening, when Shauna thought of their pilot. Irene Strebick was barely at the Army's minimum height requirement for pilots of 5'4", and that had been with her standing with perfect posture, stretching her neck. She was petite and slender, and she'd always been self-conscious about her diminutive size. Now, as far as Major Perkins and MB thought, her petite frame was an asset.
Shauna, there has got to be some other way to do this.
Skippy, come on. Isn't there another way to do this? Does she really need to squeeze down that hole? The thought of me doing that made my skin crawl.
Another way like what, Joe? Skippy asked, sounding annoyed.
I don't know, like, can we do it remotely?
Gosh, Joe, I never thought of that. What a brilliant idea, he said sarcastically.
You know, I don't have the owner's manual for that type of Kristang projector, so I looked it up on YouTube. Half the links were people doing stupid stuff, like asking me if we can do this remotely. No, we can't, you dum-dum. The Kristang didn't want anyone waking up those projectors remotely. That's why they physically disabled them. Someone needs to go down there and reconnect the power connections and plug things in.
I'd do it because I can fit down the hole easily, but darn it, I don't have thumbs, you jackass.
Sorry. Okay, send Perkins a message. Strebick needs to try. She isn't claustrophobic, is she?
Not according to her service records, but who wouldn't be claustrophobic while going 80 meters down a narrow, dark tube?
Crap. Ask her to try. If she can't do it, that's understandable.
Irene's whole body was shaking when she felt her feet finally had room to move. She swung her feet around, trying to find some place to stand. The camera on the end of the drill had shown an oval-shaped chamber, which now had a cone of dirt below where the drill had punched through the composite ceiling. The cable continued lowering her, with her shoulders scraping the sides, even though she had her arms squeezed as tightly together in front of her as she could. Without being able to move her head enough to look down, and her eyes only inches from the tube's wall, she couldn't see anything at first. The drill had sprayed a coating on the wall that hardened and prevented the dirt and rocks from collapsing in on her. MB had said the coating was considerably tougher than steel. MB was not 80 meters down in a skinny hole. Light. Even looking straight ahead, she was able to see light coming up from below. Then her right foot touched something soft. It was the cone of dirt. She continued descending and both of her feet found solid ground. Then she was able to move her arms. Her shoulders screamed at her from being cramped in one position for so long, and her eyes blinked from the sudden, unaccustomed glare of the lights they had tossed down the hole. When she could stand, she managed to report in.
I'm down, she said, and tugged on the cable twice for emphasis. No surprises here. It looks like it did from the camera. What does MB want me to do first?
Irene wanted to accomplish her tasks as quick as possible so she could clip the cable back on her harness and be pulled up, up and out.
Outstanding, Strebick, Major Perkins replied. Here's what you do.
Suck-cess, Joe, Skippy shouted excitedly.
I have established a link to the projector, and I have complete control. All systems fully operational. Who'd have guessed it? Lizards can build some good stuff when they really try.
That is great, Skippy, I said with relief. Tell Major Perkins to congratulate Strebick for us, please.
I knew Skippy would write the message in a way that Perkins could not tell it was coming from a human source.
Will do, Joe.
I will also tell Major Perkins that Strebick should not go anywhere near the control panel on the far left, because that is for the explosive charges that will blow the soil off the top of the projector and extend the Mazer cannon's muzzle.
Please do that, I said seriously.
It was great that Perkins's team had gotten a Mazer cannon reactivated. It was not great that from the time they got the drill rig initially loaded into the Buzzard, it had taken 4 days. Even with Skippy hacking into the sensors of both Ruhar and Kristang, we needed to get at least 8 projectors online as soon as possible. There was too much risk of Perkins's team being discovered. And we need to think of ways to speed up the whole process. Perkins had told Emby that she was confident future projectors could be activated much quicker now that her crew knew how to get a drill rig to a site and how to operate it. And I don't know how many times we can ask Strebick to squeeze down that tiny hole. If I did that, my nerves would be shot. And she needs to fly that Buzzard. We can't risk her having a nervous breakdown.
Oh, that's not a problem, Joe. Next time I'll explain to Major Perkins how to make the big drill bit oscillate, so it creates a larger diameter hole. Your buddies Cornpone and Ski should fit down there easily.
What? Why the hell didn't you tell them that this time?
Truthfully, I didn't consider the difficulty of one of you monkeys squeezing down a hole like that. I don't have physical limitations, so I didn't think of it. That's supposed to be your job, Joe. We could have told them to oscillate the drill bit this time, but they already had the hole open, and making the hole larger would have required as much time as drilling a second hole.
Crap. He was right. It was my job to think of practical issues.
My bad. Yes, please inform Perkins about how to drill a bigger hole in the future. Strebick should be happy about that. How's the weather forecast?
I suggested to Major Perkins that her team move with alacrity, because I am expecting rather strong thunderstorms tomorrow. It would behoove them to get the drill assembled and the sling operation completed as quickly as possible.
Alacrity? Behoove? Really, Skippy?
Hey, Joe, Major Perkins has a master's degree that your army paid for, and unlike you, she paid attention in high school. It would be good for you to expand your vocabulary sometimes, Colonel Joe.
Whatever. You knock that Kristang battle group out of the sky, and I'll let you teach me one new word every day. Deal?
Seems like I'm doing a lot more work than you, but I accept.
Uh-oh, Joe, we are running out of time, Skippy announced. We need to strike today.
What? Only 4 projectors have been activated. You told us that Perkins needs to get 8 online at minimum. Why the rush?
Circumstances have changed. I have new information. The Kristang commander is feeling confident in his control of Paradise, so he has scheduled a war game to commence later today, in about 9 hours. Ships will soon begin dispersing to participate in the attack, and we will lose the ability to hit them.
Crap. We can attack with only 4 projectors?
Oh, yeah, Joe, it's certainly not ideal, but it will work well enough. The 4 that are active now will be sufficiently effective against the battle group for an initial attack. It is for follow-on defense that we will need to have more projectors to provide full coverage. The only downside to our hastily planned attack is that the commander of the Kristang Task Force is not aboard his command ship right now. He came down to Paradise yesterday in order to investigate a bizarre accident. It seems that a dropship crashed and resulted in blowing up most of a Kristang airbase.
Huh. That is bizarre. I rolled my eyes. I wonder how that happened.
I have no idea, Joe.
That is a puzzle for sure.
Anyway, when Admiral Kikrondo left the wrecked airbase, he is really pissed about it, by the way, he flew up to a destroyer instead of the command ship. We need to take out the command ship first. It represents a significant portion of their combat power. I will hit Kikrondo's destroyer if I can. I wouldn't count on it.
I am sure this Kikrondo guy will not be heartbroken if you are not able to target the destroyer he is on.
Good point. Hey, I can send him a sorry that we missed you card.
Let's not and say we did.
With only 4 projectors online, their area of coverage was limited. Each projector could only shoot within a cone of about 28 degrees. Perkins's team had activated 4 projectors that were close to each other in order to bring projectors online as quickly as possible. While that made sense in terms of logistics, it meant there were huge areas of the sky we couldn't hit. Skippy could only guarantee to hit 8 ships, 14 at the most. The Kristang ships were varying their patrol patterns to prevent the Ruha Commodore from being tempted into an opportunistic raid. We did have an advantage, if we had time to use it. Each Kristang warship was assigned a patrol route by the command ship in order to coordinate their coverage of the planet's surface. Most of the communication was from the command ship's computer to the other ship's navigation computers, so the crews were not directly involved in most cases. Skippy had been able to gain limited access to the Kristang command ship's computer. He used that access to alter the patrol patterns. Although the patrol routes were supposed to be random, there was logic to them. The method of assigning patrol routes was to prevent too many ships from being bunched together, because that left gaps in coverage and made the task force an easy target. The challenge for Skippy was to get as many Kristang ships within the strike cones of our four projectors before some alert Kristang realized something was very wrong. Mathematically, he figured the best he could do was bring 14 ships within our strike cones at any one time. I told him not to try for the perfect solution. That carried too much risk of the enemy being alerted and blowing our whole plan. If Skippy could get a dozen ships in the virtual crosshairs of our projectors, he was to tell me immediately so I could press the big red button on my Z-phone. And if there was any sign the Kristang were catching on to our plan, we were going to shoot right away. Even with the Kristang ships flying unaltered patrol routes, there were usually 6 or 7 ships within the strike cones at any one time. Even the awesome power of the projectors would not allow us to clear enemy ships from the skies over Paradise if those ships had been ready for our attack. If those ships had the defensive shields active, even the searing power of a projector's maser beams might be deflected long enough for the ships to perform an emergency jump. Lightly protected ships like frigates would be no match for the power of a projector, but a Kristang destroyer might survive long enough to jump to safety, and a cruiser or battle cruiser could potentially deflect even 2 shots before being forced to jump away. With only 4 projectors to work with, we couldn't afford to use 2 projectors on 1 ship. Fortunately, we had the laws of physics on our side. Ships not engaged in battle could not maintain their shields at full power all the time. Defensive shields drained a significant amount of power from a ship's reactor. In the case of a small ship like a frigate, the ship had to decrease shield power temporarily in order to fire its maser cannon. Shield generators also wore out and became polarized from long-term use, so the Kristang ships around Paradise had their ships in low power mode to protect the ships only from being struck by space debris. Since shield generators could be brought to full power in seconds, and a ship would be warned of Ruha ships attacking by the telltale gamma ray burst, the Kristang felt safe leaving their shields at low power. And that meant their ships in the skies above Paradise were sitting ducks. All 4 projectors fired simultaneously to maximize the surprise. 2 of the maser cannons had clear skies above. Another had high, thin cloud cover that was no obstacle to the maser projecting its full power above the atmosphere. The 4th projector was somewhat unlucky. It was under a heavy layer of cloud cover, but at least the clouds were not pouring down rain. The heavy layer of clouds was no match for that maser cannon. It had been designed to shoot through clouds. Its initial shot was a rapid series of low-powered pulses that lanced up through the clouds, the searing heat of the maser pulses boiling away the water vapor and leaving a brief, narrow, clear channel all the way up through the cloud. 0.5 millisecond later, the maser put out its full power into the clear tunnel of air, striking a Kristang destroyer. The projector followed a shoot-shoot-look pattern, with 2 full-power shots followed by a lower-power maser scan of the target. Satisfied that the Kristang destroyer was now a wreck, the projector shifted its aim to a 2nd target, first shooting a rapid series of pulses to knock aside the clouds in that direction. The very first target struck in the engagement was the command ship, the battlecruiser, "He who pushes aside fear shall always be victorious." The maser cannon that targeted that ship, a maser shooting up through a crystal-clear sky, did not care if the ship's crew pushed aside fear or not. It also followed a standard shoot-shoot-look pattern. The first pulse lasted 0.2 milliseconds and sliced through the unprotected ship's hull. With the Victorious moving at nearly 3 kilometers per second, the maser beam did not need to move its aim. The ship did the work of cutting itself almost in half as it moved through the path of the maser bolt. One area the first maser pulse burned through was a missile magazine that was the projector's primary target. 5 missiles exploded, sending shrapnel in every direction and rupturing the ship's hull from inside. That first maser shot would have been enough to turn the Victorious from a powerful warship into a drifting hulk, but the projector was not finished.
Shrapnel from the exploding missiles had not even time to reach the aft of the ship when the second maser pulse of the shoot-shoot-look pattern targeted the battlecruiser's reactor, and an instant later a brief new sun shone in the sky high above Paradise. When the maser shifted into its lower-powered look mode, the largest piece of organized matter where the Victorious had been was about the size of a dropship. Remorselessly, the projector shifted to the second in the list of targets it had been given by an alien AI. Less than a second later, that target also exploded because a direct maser hit to the ship's jump drive capacitors released that stored energy. The maser projector then changed aim to a third target, automatically calculating how much energy from its rapidly draining capacitors would be needed for the shot.
"Done!" Skippy shouted triumphantly a few seconds later. "Scratch 12 targets! Damn, I am good! We may be able to hit another ship in a couple seconds. It's at a bad angle right now, but in a few... No, damn it, the stupid thing just jumped away. Oh well, you can't have everything. Joe, tell me the truth. Am I awesome, or am I awesome? Between those two excellent choices, I will choose awesome, Skippy. I would have celebrated your awesome awesomeness without prompting. And you are not just good. You are the best ever. How could any being be more awesome than you? Okay, maybe I was laying the praise on a little thick. I will accept your praise graciously, woefully inadequate though it is. You are doing the best your puny monkey brain can do to marvel at my awesomeness. I had to laugh. You are such an asshole sometimes, but I love you anyway. And I find you mostly almost tolerable, Joe. I appreciate that. You got a sit rep for us?
Affirmative on the sit rep, Colonel, Skippy said in a sarcastic tone. He hated military acronyms.
We hit 14 ships, and all 14 ships were completely destroyed. That includes their battlecruiser and both cruisers. Only two ships even had time to start charging their defensive shield projectors, and that didn't do them any good. It would be easier to list which ships the Kristang have left than to list the ones we destroyed.
Understood. Go ahead.
The Kristang have 10 warships remaining, 5 destroyers and 5 frigates. On the Ruhar side, the ships that are combat-ready are 1 cruiser, 3 destroyers, and 2 frigates. That cruiser would seem to give the Ruhar a slight advantage, but the Kristang design philosophy for destroyers makes them more like the equivalent of a Ruhar light cruiser. The Kristang still have the advantage of combat power.
Yeah, but we have the projectors, I reminded him.
2 of those projectors are now almost depleted, Joe. The remaining power is inadequate to penetrate the shields of a starship, even if we fired both of those projectors at the same target. Each of the other 2 healthy projectors are capable of 1 shot each. They could destroy a ship if we fired both at the same target. Unfortunately, those 2 projectors are poorly positioned to hit the same target. The enemy ship would need to be within a very small slice of the sky for the projectors to have line of sight to it. That won't happen, because now that the enemy knows where at least 4 of our projectors are, their ships will avoid the space covered by them.
Yeah, I said, looking at Adams. We need to get Perkins working on activating that other projector as soon as she can. Those Kristang ships are sure to test whether those 4 projectors are the only ones active. If we can fire another projector, the Kristang will assume we have capabilities we haven't revealed yet. If they jump in and we can't shoot at them, they'll know that we're bluffing, and then we'll be in deep shit real quick.
Skippy, can you provide cover for Perkins if her team needs to work fast? We can't let them wait for night.
Affirmative, Joe. Without the prying eyes of starships overhead, I can conceal Major Perkins's buzzard from being detected, unless someone happens to eyeball them while they are digging. And when they are done and need to fly away, I can give the pilot a route for maximum concealment. They do still have the problem of needing to refuel before they can reach the next projector site.
Joe, I do not think we will have much trouble concealing the actions of a lone buzzard.
Why is that?
Because, Joe. Very soon I expect the skies of a paradise to be filled with Ruhar and Kristang aircraft, fighting the biggest air battle in several 100 years. The Kristang landed over 300 aircraft, plus they captured additional Ruhar aircraft when they took over territory under terms of the ceasefire. The Ruhar have almost 600 aircraft, but they have a civilian population to protect, and more of their aircraft are unarmed civilian transports. Without starships overhead, those aircraft are the best way to establish control over the surface of Paradise. We should expect...
Yes. Joe, the Kristang just launched a wave of dropships and aircraft in an attack on 2 Ruhar air bases. The Ruhar have detected the launch and are scrambling aircraft to intercept. This is going to get ugly very quickly.
Sally Chernandegrin walked out of the hangar toward her Dobra fighter. The aircraft she would be flying that day was hers, which wasn't always the case, given how often high-performance Dobras needed to go off the flight line for maintenance. That day, her mission was a simple check ride to test a thruster unit that had been replaced. It should be a simple, relatively short flight. Although it was only a short flight, the Dobra was fully armed with missiles. While Kristang were still on the move and above the planet, they were technically at war. Neither Saley nor any other Ruhar trusted the Kristang to adhere to the ceasefire agreement.
"Your pet wants a cookie,"
Jeff Blander said sourly, pointing at Derek Bonsu, who was opening an access cover. The human, too eager to please, always opened the access covers so that pilots could perform their pre-flight inspections faster. Jeff was Saley's co-pilot and weapon systems officer who sat in the back seat of the Dobra.
"He's not my pet," Saley protested, knowing her words were falling on deaf ears.
Her Wizzo had nothing personal against Derek. Jeff simply did not like humans. Any humans. Like Saley, Jeff was a native to Gitanu. His family on both sides had been on Gitanu for 3 generations. His entire family had been forcibly evacuated by the humans. Jeff had been scheduled to join them on the trip up the space elevator in little over a month, when the Ruhar fleet arrived and took the planet back.
"You shouldn't be mean to him. We may be leaving this planet if the Kristang stay here, but he is going to die," she said sadly.
"They are not my problem," Jeff said angrily. "They came here with the Kristang."
He stared at the human, his anger softening. The pilot was right. If the Kristang kept Gitanu, the humans eventually would suffer a terrible fate.
"Saley, this is just a check ride," Jeff commented. "Take him instead."
"Are you sure?" Saley asked, surprised.
"Yes."
There was an increasing volume of rumors that the Ruhar federal government was not sending the fleet to fight the Kristang, that Gitanu was not important enough to fight for. If that rumor was true, Derek Bonsu did not have much longer to live. The human had actively assisted the Ruhar, helped to maintain their combat aircraft. The Kristang would find that to be an unforgivable betrayal, and the thin-skinned Kristang never forgave any slight, no matter how minor.
"This may be his last opportunity to fly." "Go," he urged, "before I change my mind."